Hi, I'm at Beijing South Station, about to get on train G19 to Shanghai. Covering a distance about the same as Seattle to San Francisco, New York to Atlanta, or Paris to Madrid. It's gonna take me 4.5 hours. This is one of the literally hundreds of trains that travel from Beijing to Shanghai every day, and G19 has one of the fastest schedules, making it one of the fastest scheduled trains in the whole world. In order to make that schedule, it needs to go an average of about 180 miles an hour, or 290 kilometers an hour. And that's counting the two stops on the way, in Jinan and Nanjing. I'm pretty sure China's high-speed train network is fairly common knowledge the world over, but nothing really prepares you for how amazing it is in person. I've ridden European high-speed trains a fair amount before, but this is a cut above. In almost every possible way, aside from a few gripes, I think these are the best trains in the world. How? I'm Tor, and welcome to China. I'm long-haired 2025 Tor, that was short-haired 2023 Tor, and this is our co-host, Jollibee the Durian. When people ask me why I chose to study abroad in China, I give three answers. To learn the language, to explore a country as culturally different from my own as possible, and to ride the Gaotias. Gaotia is what the high-speed trains in China are called in Mandarin. It's short for Gaosu Tielu, which means high-speed railroad. The way you make acronyms in Chinese, or something sort of like acronyms, is that you take the first characters of each phrase, so Gao Tie, which out of context means high rail. A high rail is a thing in American railroading too, but something a little less sleek. It's a pickup truck outfitted with rudimentary train wheels so it can drive on train tracks to inspect the track. That's a tangent. Let's get back to China. At the time that I was in China, in fall 2023, they had built 28,000 miles of dedicated high-speed track, and they keep on opening new lines, even though every single major city is now connected to the system, and every province has high-speed track in it, including Hainan, the island one. China plans to build half again as many miles of Gaotia by 2035, reaching 45,000 miles, about the total length of the US interstate highway system. I'm not even sure they need that much. China is already home to two-thirds of the world's high-speed rail. Every single major city is connected to every other major city by several high-speed trains a day. Once, while I was there, I took a train from Kunming in the southwest to Beijing in the northeast, the longest scheduled high-speed service in the world. It takes 8 hours, and it's the equivalent in distance of going from New Orleans to Toronto. There are only a few stops along the way, only in the biggest cities, but if I was going to a smaller town that my train passed right through, like Chinese small town, so just a few million people, I could get off in a major city and get on a shorter distance high-speed train that's still high-speed but makes more stops. That's the most amazing thing about the Chinese high-speed rail system. It truly goes everywhere. I don't know what the biggest city in China that's not near a high-speed track is, but it's not a big one. Just from looking at a map, it might be Yan'an, which is not even in the top 50 biggest cities, and it's kind of interesting that the government wouldn't bother to build a high-speed line to Yan'an because it's a really important city in the history of the founding of the CCP. Another country with good high-speed trains is France, and I've lived there too, but the French high-speed system is pretty bare bones. In 2012, I lived in Bordeaux, one of the 10 biggest cities in France, about 30 years after the first French high-speed line opened, and even then, Bordeaux wasn't on the national high-speed system. You could take a high-speed train from Paris to Bordeaux, but only the first third or so of the trip would be at full speed on a dedicated high-speed line, the last 200 miles or so to Bordeaux would be on a slower track, shared with regional trains and freight trains. France finally opened a fully high-speed line to Bordeaux in 2017, at which point China had already overtaken their high-speed mileage several times over, and there are still big cities like Toulouse that aren't on the high-speed system. And even in a city that is on the high-speed system, if you're going to any other major city but Paris, good luck finding a direct fast train. China is way bigger, way poorer, and started building high-speed trains a quarter century after France did. Now its high-speed system is 20 times bigger by mileage. How did they do it? Well, China's trains weren't originally China's trains. In the early 2000s, when China's economy was growing 10% a year, for comparison, in Western countries, 3% a year is considered good, the government set their sights on building some high-speed trains. It had been a dream China had since the 70s, when their then-leader Deng Xiaoping visited Japan and got jealous of the Shinkansen. When China first got serious about building high-speed trains, they were planning to buy Japanese technology off the shelf, but the government began looking for other alternatives, ostensibly because of a public uproar about Japan's World War II war crimes against the Chinese, but probably also so that they could evaluate the pros and cons of different countries' technologies on their own tracks. China requested bids to build trains from world-leading engineering firms, with one caveat. Any big firm that wants into the Chinese market needs to establish a joint venture with a Chinese government company to build their trains in China. Four companies were selected, the four main builders of high-speed trains worldwide: Kawasaki of Japan, Alstom of France, Siemens of Germany, and Bombardier of Canada, which builds high-speed trains for Europe. There aren't any high-speed trains in Canada. Each of them designed a train for China that looked like the trains they'd already built in their home countries. But since these trains were being built in China by joint venture Chinese companies, China held the patents to these trains that looked like foreign high-speed trains. And after the first generation of Gaotiers were already tearing through the Chinese countryside, designed by foreign companies, China decided to use the patents they'd gained from the foreign firms to design their own 100% Chinese high-speed train. It was unveiled in 2015, and called this. That's pronounced Fuxing, and it means rejuvenation, roughly. I've seen it translated as Renaissance, and that might be the closest possible translation, not the historical era, but like rebirth, like cultural metaphorical rebirth. It's not a rare word to see in China. It's in a lot of brand names. There used to be a Fuxing Hotel in central Beijing where a lot of foreign dignitaries stayed, and the people in charge never understood why Westerners kept stealing towels and stationery as souvenirs. The train is different. I honestly think that they named their all-Chinese high-speed train design Fuxing with full knowledge of what it looks like in English, and that might even have factored into the decision to call it that, because building it was a deliberate break from the West. They wanted to say, we can do this all by ourselves. If the name of the train sounds funny to you, that's because this train is by and for the Chinese, and you don't matter to us. The big European and Japanese engineering companies had basically been bamboozled into building a Chinese-run, Chinese-owned high-speed train company from scratch. They thought they were going to be major players in China's rail industry for as long as there were high-speed trains in China. Now, the Chinese are building high-speed trains with China's own technology and China's own patents all over the world. The trains are based on the technology they transferred from the West, but they're made and designed in China. And the money made by the Fuxing trains in Indonesia, Laos, Turkey, and other middle-income countries flows back into China's coffers. Now, if China were willing to let Indonesia and Turkey and the like do the same thing that the Western companies gamely let China do, use their technology to build their own local high-speed industries, I'd support that. I don't like copyright, I don't like the doctrine of intellectual property, I think patents stifle innovation, but China is not doing it out of some high-minded desire to distribute open-source high-speed train designs to the world. They want China to be the world's only big maker of high-speed trains. Some people frame the technology transfer as China stealing designs for high-speed trains from the West, and I don't think that's a totally inaccurate read on the situation. There's a saying in engineering: cheap fast, good. You can only pick two. A lot of people, in the Chinese and Western media alike, claim that the Chinese high-speed train system is all three of those things at once. But it can't be. So which of these does China sacrifice? Are the high-speed trains fast? Are hamsters fluffy? Is Jollibee a durian? Yeah, of course they're fast. It's the French who hold the world record for the fastest conventional train. They hit a record of 357 miles an hour in 2007, but that was with a specially designed speed record setting train as a publicity stunt. In regular service with normal paying passengers on board, Chinese high-speed trains are definitely the world's fastest. The French max out at 200 miles an hour, 320 kilometers an hour. The Fuxing trains have a top speed of 220 miles an hour, 350 kilometers, and express services between far apart cities will sometimes stay at that top speed for hours, ripping through stations at full speed. Being on the platform as a Fuxing comes through at 220 miles an hour is one of those things that can only be experienced in person. They're running at over a quarter the speed of sound, so like a fighter jet, the sound slightly lags the train. You see the train approaching, but you don't hear it at all until it's right on top of you, when it sounds like a thunderclap. Pretty soon, China is going to launch a new model of train that has a top speed of 400 kilometers an hour, 250 miles an hour. Although that's so fast that even most of the high-speed tracks aren't ready for trains that fast, and they won't be allowed to go their full speed until 2027. But that's not what the cheap, fast, good aphorism really means. It means, is it fast to build it? And it sure is! The Beijing to Shanghai high-speed railway, 819 miles of state-of-the-art track, began construction in April 2008 and entered service slightly more than 3 years later, in June 2011. By comparison, this year Los Angeles is going to open a 4-mile, 3-stop extension of one of their subway lines. It began construction in 2014. Enough said. Okay, so is China's construction any good? It can't be, right? When I did a video about slow train lines in China, I got a lot of comments along the lines of, enjoy those trains now because it's not gonna last. It's built on tofu. I think the people leaving those comments were mostly Westerners, but that sure is a common turn of phrase in China, albeit one that people don't say very loud. Quickly built shoddy construction gets dubbed doufu jia gong chang, tofu dreg construction. They're not just saying it's built out of tofu, it's built out of tofu dregs, the slimy soy pulp left over from making tofu. And yeah, there are some terrifying videos of tofu dreg construction out there. How would you feel if you lived on the 30th floor of one of those dour high-rises where so many Chinese people live and you saw this? Tofu dreg construction is synonymous with China's real estate boom. Throughout the 2000s and 10s, massive housing conglomerates threw up massive housing all over China. Rent kept on going up. There were always going to be buyers. One of the most striking experiences of modern China is taking a gaotia from anywhere to anywhere and inevitably passing by developments of 20 identical, completely featureless 50-story high-rises sprouting like alien fortresses out of the absolute middle of nowhere and thinking, do people really live there? And increasingly the answer is no. Unfinished and unattended buildings are a common sight in China these days, especially in rural areas. The world's 10th tallest building is a 117-story skyscraper on the outskirts of Tianjin, which topped out but never got completed. I've been there, and it's a surreal scene. It's in a light industrial area with office parks and warehouses and stuff. Not just the tallest building around, but the only tall building at all, looming over suburban Tianjin like a very on-the-nose metaphor. The Golden Finance 117, as the Tianjin skyscraper was going to be called, was intended as an office building, but most tall abandoned buildings in China were intended to be residential. Until the bottom fell out of China's housing market post-COVID, the real estate boom had become a massive Ponzi scheme. Construction conglomerates built forests of high-rises in the middle of nowhere, with no thought to the question, are people going to live in these? Meanwhile, as the conglomerates pumped out more and more high-rises with the cheapest materials possible, the rent got higher and higher for ordinary people. Check out this map. Average rent as a share of average income. You think your rent is too damn high? As the 2010s went on, China's growth was increasingly built first and foremost on seeing housing as an investment rather than a necessity. This has become another common sight in Chinese cities. I think most of the buildings in this video are being deliberately collapsed, but I'm not sure. Could the high-speed train lines be as shoddy as the high-rises? Well, they're not built by private companies like Alta Housing, but the government has a similar incentive to keep cranking them out, whether or not they're safe. Not for money, but for prestige. Officially, the Gaotiers have a damn good safety record. There have been two deadly accidents on the Chinese high-speed rail system, but both involved natural circumstances, largely outside the railroad's control. The first one, outside the city of Wenzhou in 2011, happened when lightning struck a signaling and electrical system used by a brand new high-speed line, causing one train to lose electrical power and come to a stop. Then, since the signals were down, another train slammed into it from behind. Since the crew of that train couldn't be warned in time, there was a disabled train on the tracks. 40 people died. This was an accident involving high-speed trains, but it was not a high-speed accident. The train that collided was going just 62 miles an hour. But it sparked a national reckoning about how safe the Gaotiers really were. They were brand new in 2011, many Chinese were afraid of them even before the Wenzhou accident, and the accident made ridership collapse. Passenger numbers didn't recover for a few years. Construction was paused on new high-speed lines to make more safety improvements and ensure this would never happen again. Speeds were temporarily reduced on the whole high-speed system, officials were fired, and it was generally a huge scandal, one of the biggest news stories of 2011 in China. And it seems like the scrutiny on the Gaotiers' safety worked, because now there are orders of magnitude more high-speed trains running every day in China, and only one deadly crash has happened in the 14 years since then. A train plowed into a landslide in summer 2022, which killed only the driver. The signals correctly displayed that the track was obstructed, but the landslide had happened so recently that the train didn't have time to stop. Statistically, then, that's pretty remarkable. If you go off the number of fatal accidents, not only are the Gaotiers one of the safest modes of transit in the world, neither of the two fatal accidents can really be put down to shoddy construction. But this is China, arguably the most tightly controlled media ecosystem in the world, and information they don't want getting out won't get out. One fascinating illustration of this that I'm not sure is true, but there certainly seems to be some evidence for. A few months ago, I saw someone claiming that a disproportionate number of mass casualty events in China have specifically 35 victims. After there was a massacre in the southern city of Zhuhai last November, where an angry divorced man drove an SUV through a crowd of people, so this wasn't the only attack like it recently in China. The people who would shoot up schools in America drive cars through crowds in China. Anyway, before there was any definite information on the international newswire about the Zhuhai car massacre, I came across one purported China expert asserting that once an official death toll was revealed, it would probably be 35 people. A couple days later, the official death toll comes out. Sure enough, 35 people. According to this person, and please do take this with a grain of salt, I have no idea if this is true, but if there's a mass casualty event with more than 35 victims in a Chinese city, the mayor gets fired. So they want to be sure that no official death toll exceeds 35 people. So whenever the media says 35 people died in China, that's a minimum bound that probably doesn't mean just 35. And I found some evidence that this is true. In 2013, there were riots in Xinjiang. Official death count? 35. In fact, if you look up day of news coverage of the Wenzhou train accident, they also say 35 people were killed. Only once Beijing announced that people would be fired for allowing the accident to happen did the reported death toll tick up to 40. So, if we don't know exactly how many people died in any accident in China, what's to say there haven't been a whole bunch of gruesome Gaotia accidents that have just been hushed up? But that's improbable. Even if we don't know the exact details, we know the existing accidents happened. The global coverage of the Wenzhou accident includes all kinds of embarrassing details that the CCP probably wouldn't want the world to know, like how local officials were initially instructed to start burying the train cars with the bodies of the victims inside. No censorship is 100% successful. If the CCP could cover up the existence of lots of train accidents, they'd have covered up the Wenzhou accident and the Zhuhai massacre. Word would get out. It seems like there's enough evidence to take China at their word. The high-speed trains are safe. Tofu dredge construction is a real issue, but the Gaotias are China's flagship project. No tofu for them. Okay, so if the trains are fast and good, how can they also be cheap? Because they definitely are. High-speed rail construction costs in China average about $20 million per kilometer of track, according to the World Bank, as opposed to a recent estimate of over $100 million per kilometer for the beleaguered high-speed rail project under construction in California. This seems to be one thing that really can't happen here. Most of the answer is that China is just a poorer country with lower labor costs. When I was in Beijing, I loved being able to get a whole roast duck for 15 yuan. That's about $2. That was my lunch almost every day. A country with $2 duck is just going to be able to do everything more affordably. Another reasonable answer is that there are economies of scale. When you're building this much high-speed rail, this fast, you can improve on the individual cost for each railroad tie and signal light and viaduct pillar and tunnel boring machine if you're mass-producing them all by the thousands. The other answer is that despite that promising banner number, the high-speed trains really are not that cheap. China is about one quarter as rich as France, but according to the transit expert Alan Levy, who is one of the people I trust the most about the nitty-gritty policy of building transit, France has high-speed construction costs of 25 million per kilometer, barely much more than China. The Spaniards managed a staggering 14 million per kilometer for their Madrid to Barcelona high-speed rail, cheaper even than China. And Spain is 2.5 times richer than China. So it's not just Chinese high-speed rail is cheaper because everything in China is cheaper. When I was booking Gaotia tickets, I noticed that the ticket price is quite a bit higher than anything comparable in China and similar to airline tickets over the same distance. A second-class seat on that train I took at the beginning of this video, G19 from Beijing to Shanghai, will set me back $91. That's in dollars, not yuan, if I travel on that train on an ordinary Monday 2 months from now. On that same Monday, if I try to book an Amtrak from New York to DC, the most comparable pair of cities in America, and sure, it's not apples to apples, but no other pair of major US cities are connected by lots of trains at varying levels of speed every day, and once again, I pick the fastest, most premier train on the line, that would be this Acela, then the cheapest seat on that train, and that's $65. Okay! Sure, that's a sale price, but even the regular fare is not as much as the one in China. I really wasn't expecting that. I was expecting that I'd have to look up the median hourly salary in the US and China, median annual income, and do some comparisons to see if, relatively speaking, high-speed train tickets are more unaffordable for the average Chinese person than they'd otherwise be. But nope. In the US, the cheapest ticket on the fastest train is cheaper, not in any relative sense, in absolute numbers, than the cheapest ticket on the fastest train in China. Tickets on the Gaotias really are way more expensive than other trains in China. Really, anything else comparable in China. You can get an overnight Lüpihuoche ticket from Beijing to Shanghai for single-digit prices in dollars if you book far enough out. Let's compare to Spain, a country that is, once again, crazy good at building quality infrastructure on the cheap. See, way, way cheaper. In fact, now I want to do a whole episode on what Spain's dark secret could possibly be, since the more research I've done into different countries' high-speed rail systems, the more the stats seem to show that Spain, not China, is the best country in the world at building high-speed trains. Anyway, China's high-speed trains have disproportionately high ticket prices relative to China still being a fairly poor country, and that's not the only way China seems to be having trouble paying for all the construction they've done. For a supposedly communist country, the Gaotiers are aggressively capitalist. There are ads on the outside of some of the trains, which I've never seen on high-speed trains anywhere else, and while the train's in motion, the stewardesses do product pitches to the passengers. Like, maybe your train will be sponsored by Starbucks, and the stewardesses will try to get you to buy Starbucks coffee on board for ridiculous prices. Or maybe they'll try to sell you elaborate leather-bound books about Chinese history, which I'm sure is exactly what Mao would have wanted. Now, not every Gaotier trip has product placement, but a lot do. On my way back to Beijing from Baotou, on the trip that I mentioned in my last China episode, the stewardesses tried to sell me a model Fuxing train, which I wanted so bad, obviously, but I figured it would be too big to fit in my backpack when I went back home to Oregon with all my other souvenirs, and if I wanted a model Fuxing train, I could order one once I'm home. I like to say that, despite all the hammers and sickles you see around, China is far more of a capitalist dystopia than any Western country you've ever seen. During COVID, the South China Morning Post, a paper that's pretty close to the regime and not likely to report embarrassing stories like this unless they're true, reported that China Railways was nearing $1 trillion in debt. I'm not sure which direction their debt has gone since then, but still, that's more debt than most whole countries. China banked on the high-speed trains delivering growth, and for a time they did. The Paulson Institute, a think tank that studies US-China relations, did a study in 2020 that found that the high-speed trains generated billions of dollars in return on investment, and I believe that. They connected China like never before. But now, China's been connected, and the more Gaotia China builds, the deeper they get into debt. Even though I can say with some confidence that up to this point, China's build-out of the high-speed system is unambiguously good, and they've built one of the greatest transportation systems in history, that's the thing. They've already built it. I don't think the CCP realizes that China's crazy growth spurt is over, and it's not coming back. Not only do I think they won't reach their target of 45,000 miles by 2035, I don't think they should try. We've hit the point of diminishing returns. When I said the Beijing to Shanghai train was the fastest in the world, I only meant that on a technicality. It's the fastest train in the world on wheels. This is the Shanghai Maglev, about to get into the station, and it's the true fastest train in the world. Instead of running on wheels, the maglev uses strong repelling magnets to hover above its track, which allows it to go a lot faster with less energy and supposedly less maintenance because it doesn't have any friction. Hear that? Doesn't sound like it has wheels, does it? The Shanghai Maglev gets up to 430 kilometers an hour. That's about 270 miles an hour on its 18-mile track connecting a metro interchange in suburban Shanghai to the city's main international airport. It's the only high-speed maglev train in the world that's open to the public, although there's a much longer one on a test track in Japan, which Tom Scott has a video about. If you arrive in Shanghai at the airport and get on the maglev into the city, you still aren't anywhere near downtown once you get to the end of the line. In order to get into the city center from the maglev, you get on Metro Line 2, which you could also have got on right at the airport. It takes a lot longer, but it's cheaper and a one-seat ride. So then, what really is the purpose of the maglev? Well, for one thing, it does make it that much faster to get to the airport, but it's really just to demonstrate future maglevs. It was built in the early 2000s by a German firm that was convinced maglev rail was the wave of the future. China was interested, and the government initially announced that the entire Beijing to Shanghai high-speed rail line they were planning wouldn't be a conventional train, it would be a maglev. They backed down on this plan when they saw how much it would cost to build, and even more important, how much it would cost to maintain, so they built it with conventional high-speed trains instead. But they decided they would extend the Shanghai Maglev line to Hangzhou, a major city about 100 miles away, and then backed down on that plan, too, building that line with wheels on rails, too. But then they said they were going to extend the Shanghai Maglev to connect to Shanghai's other airport, which is also where the high-speed trains to Beijing leave from, so that would be awfully convenient, and then they built that as an ordinary metro line too. Then they said that they would at least extend the Maglev so that it gets closer to the city center, and they didn't do that either. At every turn, the powers that be decided that the costs of building more Maglev outweighed the benefits. And while this story is disappointing, a surprising number of transit geeks are probably gloating at the failure of the Maglev, because you know what the Maglev is? A gadget bond. Gadget bond is a term coined in the early 2000s by transit buffs, originally meaning a transit system that is unnecessarily technologically advanced, when an ordinary train would do just as well. These days, gadget bond has undergone the same concept creep that terms like neoliberalism or critical race theory have gone through, where it originally meant one specific thing out of many things that a particular group doesn't like, and gradually inflated to mean anything that that group doesn't like. Basically anything that isn't a conventional as possible steel wheels on steel rails train gets called a gadget bond by urbanist Twitter these days. But a maglev is a true gadget bond. Now, you don't have to convince me, of all people, that trains are the best transit solution we've got. You don't have to convince me that improving on the concept of trains is usually neither easy nor necessary. But despite all that, I'm pro-gadget bond, especially in a country where people don't tend to ride transit, even if it's good. You know who you are, and hint, I'm not talking about China. The solution to getting ordinary people who don't see themselves as poor and aren't autistic to ride transit is to build a lot of gadget bonds, because unless you're a rail fan, trains aren't fun. There's not that many of us. It may be hard for you and I to imagine, but to most people, trains are just background noise. But you know what's fun? You know what's interesting? You know what's equal parts a mode of transit and a tourist attraction? A fucking maglev.
I stand by more or less what I said on the maglev. In America, a few gadget bonds might be exactly what we need. Americans associate public transit with the poor, but they don't associate sexy sci-fi modes of transportation with public transit. I mean, Oregon, where I live, already has a successful gadget bond, the Portland Aerial Tram. The Aerial Tram, which was built to connect the riverfront campus of a medical school with the main hospital up on a hill, is a real example of a successful gadget bond. It's a mode of transportation that barely exists in most other places, it serves its transportation purpose better than any conventional mode of transit could, it gets plenty of day-to-day commuter passengers, and it draws tourists and it's a local icon. Hell, I think you only need two of those three to be true in order to declare a gadget bond successful. Every American city should have its own unique gadget bond. But by that metric, is the Shanghai Maglev a successful gadget bond? No. It draws tourists and it's a local icon, yes. It definitely doesn't get plenty of day-to-day commuter passengers. I was one of the only passengers on the whole train when I filmed that video. Does it serve its transportation purpose better than any conventional mode of transit? Not really. It sure is faster than taking the subway to the airport, but other Chinese cities have direct high-speed rail links to their airports with conventional wheels on rails, and those work just as well. I got this comment on my previous China trains video, where I included a picture of the maglev for just a second, and I'm going to describe the maglev this way to everyone I meet from here on out, because I love this comment. It doesn't really lev mags. In fact, I'm going to start saying this in non-maglev-related contexts.
Hey, have you listened to Billie Eilish's latest album?
It doesn't really lev mags. And what's more, the Shanghai Maglev doesn't even go its top speed anymore. I didn't even know this when I rode it in October 2023, but I never got to experience the Maglev at its full speed. Since May 2021, it's been limited to 300 km per hour, 186 miles per hour, apparently for noise and maintenance reasons, and that's slower than the conventional high-speed trains in China, so now it has no advantage whatsoever over normal rail. But China is really still trying to make the maglev happen. They've considered that maybe the reason the maglev doesn't lev mags is because it's still too slow. If it were way, way faster than any conventional train, then maybe it would make sense to build some maglev tracks. Right now, CRRC, the Chinese state-owned train building company, is working on building a maglev that can go 600 kilometers per hour, 373 miles an hour, which would definitely be the fastest train in the world, eclipsing even that French train that was purpose-built to set the record. And they're very proud of it and want to show it off to foreigners. Like me! When I was in China, my whole foreign exchange group got to go to Chengdu to visit the maglev test facility at Southwest Jiaotong University. It wasn't even my idea. This had been a planned, non-skippable activity since before I signed on to the program. The maglev prototype being tested in Chengdu is a Chinese-designed concept that uses liquid nitrogen to cool the superconducting magnets on the track, and it's one of two maglev prototypes China is testing out right now, both of which are planned to reach 600 kilometers an hour. The other one has a test track in Shanghai and is based on the same German tech the current Shanghai maglev uses. At the Chengdu lab I visited, they had two model test tracks that demonstrate how the whole thing works, one of which is a Mobius strip, showing that the maglev technology even works upside down, which I hope is just for show and isn't something they're planning to have the real maglev do. And the reason they had those model test tracks was because the real thing was deeply unimpressive. Yeah, they had a full-size maglev train, but it was on a 500-foot test track. This clip is almost the entirety of one ride on the Chengdu maglev.
It's jiggling violently.
And we topped out at like 15 kilometers an hour.
Here we are at the other end of the line.
And here it is from the outside. I could have walked parallel to it at the same speed, and when it was going back, I did. And as we visited the maglev lab, my whole Waiguo Ren squad was being shadowed and filmed and occasionally interviewed by a crew from Xinhua News. So here I am, enthusiastically participating in foreign propaganda. They had me run a few different takes of this clip to make sure I was enthusiastically participating. As the whitest kids you know once said, happier and with your mouth open. Excites US students, yeah? I sure bet it does.
I love the high-speed trains. I came to China for two reasons, to learn Chinese and ride the high-speed trains.
It's not that hard to push. I've certainly never pushed a train this light before.
I was amazed by the Mobius Strip maglev test track.
One rather odd detail of that day. I was wearing extremely saggy pants. I can explain the pushing. They have people do that to demonstrate how light the train is. I cannot explain the pants. When I took this video for myself, this wasn't part of the Xinhua broadcast, I sent it to Kinley, my friend who composed the music for Tor's Cabinet, and he said I looked like I was in a 90s rap video. And he wasn't wrong. So, this maglev hasn't gotten up to 600 kilometers an hour yet. It hasn't even gotten up to a speed that a reasonably fast human couldn't catch up to it on foot. And neither has the other Chinese maglev prototype, which has an only slightly longer test track in Shanghai. Here's a video of it. The speed of this clip has not been adjusted in any way. It just looks like that. Now, maybe it'll work. Maybe someday some of the busiest corridors in China will have 600 kilometer an hour maglev tracks built along them. And that'll be cool, but To make it as useful as the Gautier network, it'll need to go to every major city, same as the Gautiers, and I don't think there's much of an appetite for building a whole second high-speed rail network across the country after taking on $1 trillion in debt building the first one. And as the new models of Fuxing train are rolled out and the existing tracks are retrofitted to handle them, 600 kilometers an hour won't be that much faster. Again, China railways have got a good thing going, but they've already got it. Don't fuck with the formula, and don't lev them mags. So, of course, the age-old question, why can't America have this? It's tempting to say, ugh, capitalism, the cheapest way to sound smart. The reason America doesn't have high-speed rail is because of the car industry lobby, or the oil industry lobby, or the airline lobby. And look, there are a couple clear cases of that. In the 90s, there were attempts at building a privately funded high-speed rail system connecting the Texas Triangle, the Houston area, the Austin-San Antonio area, and the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. But those routes were also Southwest Airlines' biggest moneymakers, and Southwest founded a lobbying organization to successfully scuttle the project. But it's not as clear-cut as you'd think. For every case of an airline trying to beat a high-speed rail project, there's a case of an airline trying to join a high-speed rail project. 10 years later, when Texas made another attempt at building that railroad, American Airlines and Continental Airlines joined the advisory board of the project and funded a lobbying blitz in support of it. Both carriers had big hubs in Texas at the time that made more money flying people to and from Texas than they did flying people within Texas, and they thought that a high-speed rail system with stops at the Dallas and Houston airports connecting them to all the major cities and some smaller towns of Texas would be a win-win for everyone. And America's roads are bad compared to other countries too, and so are America's airports. If the airline industry and the car industry had as much of a stranglehold on US transportation policy as people claim, we'd at least be building cool new airports and cool new interstates. We're not doing either of those things either. If you want to see an industry that really does use its outsized lobbying power to get things built for it, look at pro sports. American cities sure are building cool new stadiums with taxpayer money, but most of those stadiums are built where old stadiums used to be, and fundamentally a stadium is a smaller project than almost any transportation project. The real answer is, America can't build high-speed rail because America can't build anything big. There is an active high-speed rail project under construction in America. It's in California, and it was originally planned to connect San Francisco to Los Angeles. Supposedly, that's still the goal. But the section that's under construction is going from Merced to Bakersfield in the dusty Central Valley. I'll avoid hating on the Central Valley too much in this video because hating on the Central Valley is one of the cheapest, tiredest jokes you can hear a Californian make, and even though I live right next to the UC Eugene campus, otherwise known as the University of Oregon, I'm not even a Californian. Wait till you hear my zingers about airline food and NFTs. Anyway, Merced and Bakersfield and the cities between them probably have some redeeming factors. They're probably perfectly nice places to live. I've only ever driven through those places, but I have plenty of experience with Sacramento, and I am Sacramento's second strongest soldier after Greta Gerwig. Sacramento is a great American city. But still, you can't deny that Merced and Bakersfield are not San Francisco and Los Angeles, and nobody would ever propose a 220-mile-per-hour high-speed train just connecting them. That initial operating segment, when it finally opens in the early 2030s, will have been under construction for almost 20 years. It's an almost completely flat, completely straight stretch of track. It represents 35% of the total way from the Bay Area to LA, and most of the rest of the planned route involves digging long, expensive tunnels through mountains. $11 billion have already been spent on the easy-to-build part. No source of funding has been identified for the harder to build parts, which are estimated to amount to 80% of the project's cost. There is no date for when or if construction will start on the parts connecting to the Bay Area and LA. SNCF, the French Rail Authority, which has a long history of building successful high-speed rail lines, initially considered helping California with the project, but in 2011, before any construction had begun, they quit. They instead went to Morocco, a country they called less politically dysfunctional, where they built a successful high-speed rail line from scratch within 7 years. It's controversial in rail fan circles to say that the California high-speed rail is a failure. It's going to open, right? We're going to have a 220-mile-per-hour train in America someday, and that's as fast as the ones in China. The construction won't have been cheap and won't have been fast, but at least it'll be good, right? And I hope so! But if you were looking at this situation in any other country, you'd call it a failure. When trains finally launch between Merced and Bakersfield, it'll be a Pyrrhic victory, achieved after decades of slogging through what may be the most dysfunctional major infrastructure project in the world. There's another active high-speed rail project under construction in America. It's also in California. This one is called the Bright Line West, and it's connecting LA to Las Vegas, a slightly longer distance than the initial operating segment of the California high-speed rail, with a lot more mountains and other difficult terrain to cross. It just began construction this year, after first being announced in 2018. It's planned to be open in 2028, and while I'm anticipating it probably getting delayed by a year or two because that's how these projects shake out, I do think it'll open without massive delays. In other words, when the initial operating segment of the California HSR began construction, the Bright Line West hadn't even been proposed yet, and by the time the initial operating segment of the California HSR finishes construction, the Bright Line West will already have been running high-speed trains on a longer track through rougher terrain for at least a year. Why do I think that this one has such better prospects than the Central Valley Line? Number one, it doesn't have any fussy land acquisition issues because it's going to be built almost entirely along the median strip of Interstate 15, between the car lanes. Locals can't sue over noise pollution because the highway's already noisy. It doesn't go through any environmentally sensitive areas because they already built the highway through those areas back when nobody cared about that stuff. A huge number of the obstacles presented by building a high-speed line across the farmlands and oil fields of the Central Valley are removed by just building the track down the middle of an existing freeway. Number two, the state of California doesn't have a track record of building good transit in recent years. The Bright Line Company does. Bright Line West is being built by America's only successful private passenger rail company, which already operates a non-high-speed but excellent by American standards intercity train in Florida, connecting Miami to Orlando. It's the only intercity passenger service in the U.S. that isn't run by Amtrak and isn't like a luxury cruise train. It tops out at 125 miles per hour, which doesn't make it the fastest train in the U.S. That's the aforementioned Amtrak Acela in the Northeast, which is allowed to reach 150 miles an hour on a few very short, very isolated segments of its track in Rhode Island and Massachusetts, but it puts the Florida Bright Line at a healthy second place. I've seen transit YouTubers call the Florida Bright Line, quote, a fantastic train that shouldn't exist because the government should be providing trains of this caliber, not the private sector. But they don't. And the way their incentive structure is set up, arguably they can't. As it is, I've never seen anyone claim that the Florida Bright Line is bad, actually. Notwithstanding the justifiable gripes about how nice it would be if Amtrak could be this good, there's a substantial consensus in railfan world that the Bright Line is the best passenger train in America. There have been no major Bright Line L's yet, other than their eye-watering number of collisions with cars and pedestrians, and that's not the train operator's fault. That's a hazard that comes from having to run trains next to thousands of Florida men every day. And that won't happen on the Bright Line West, since the Bright Line West won't have any grade crossings. I trust the Bright Line people to deliver on the LA to Vegas ambitions. The Bright Line West isn't perfect. The Bright Line people's MO seems to be that of cheap, fast, and good, they consciously chose to sacrifice good. For now. They want a basic service which doesn't meet full high-speed standards running at first, and then they'll scale up amenities one by one as they get more passengers. For example, the Bright Line West is going to be mostly single track at first, with sidings along the way for trains to pass each other. Schedules will be set up so that trains normally won't have to wait for each other to pass, but if your train gets delayed by something going on at the station, it'll probably have to wait at every siding for the trains coming the other way. Also, the LA end of it won't connect directly to LA. The LA area terminus for the Bright Line West will initially be in Rancho Cucamonga, connected to downtown LA by an hour-long commuter rail ride. But Brightline has plans to scale things up once they have a working high-speed train making money, and they will have that pretty soon. The right-of-way will be wide enough to add a second track the whole way once they need one. That's how the newly built sections of the Florida Brightline were designed too, and just a couple years after that opened, they already have enough traffic that they're putting in that second track. And they have plans already in place to extend the Brightline into downtown LA. Who knows if they'll get the permitting for that done before the initial Brightline West is completed. After they have a successful semi-high-speed train in Florida, and a successful true high-speed train in California and Nevada, what will Brightline do next? I expect then we'll see Brightline Texas, which is a project their CEO, Wes Edens, has already talked about. Right now, there's a tentative plan for a high-speed line between Dallas and Houston using Japanese technology, operated by a partnership between Amtrak and a private company called Texas Central Railway, but neither Amtrak nor Japan are treating it as a serious priority. Brightline could easily snap up the Texas Central project and, with the money and expertise they've gained from Brightline East and West, build a successful high-speed train in Texas. And then what? Brightline South, connecting Atlanta to Charlotte or Nashville? Plausible. And hell, I expect the only way we're gonna get a Bay Area to Los Angeles high-speed train in our lifetimes is if the state of California sells the whole project to Brightline, and I think they will. After they have the initial operating segment running, but they still have no idea how they'll pay for the rest of the system, they'll unload it onto Brightline to sort out the mess. By then, Brightline's in-house team of engineers will know exactly how to build high-speed rail in America, and Brightline will get it connected to their existing tracks in SoCal and finish the California HSR. High-speed trains will be making their way across America at last, built and operated largely by the private sector. If you're a leftist who dreams of America building a national high-speed rail system, the finger on the monkey's paw might be about to curl. I think high-speed trains in America now are like electric cars in America in 2010. In 2010, you could buy an electric car, but they were shitty at that point, without much range, completely uncompetitive with gas cars, and it definitely marked you as a left-wing weirdo who's overly concerned about the environment. It was a very non-mainstream thing to want. Maybe you dreamed of a future where some brilliant immigrant engineer had a vision to put an electric car in every garage. Someone who revolutionizes battery technology, fights the big auto industry and wins, and for a time makes electric cars the coolest thing in the world. And by 2025, maybe, in that utopian future, electric cars would have 10% market share in the US, a figure that keeps growing, and in most major cities it would be hard to walk down the street for 5 minutes without seeing an electric car. Well, we got that utopian future, and now that electric cars are mainstream, they're certainly not something left-coded anymore. That brilliant immigrant engineer who made electric cars mainstream is the main benefactor of far-right politics the world over. But seeing what's happened to electric cars, I think it's very plausible that something like that could happen to high-speed trains in America. In the 2012 presidential debates, Mitt Romney called Elon Musk a loser because he was at that point largely being funded by government loans, and that statement sent progressive blogs and Democratic politicians into a tizzy defending Elon as an environmental visionary. Brightline, too, has gotten heaps of money from the feds, and maybe at first that'll get Republicans to attack them. I'm sure some people have already commented that, you know, Brightline isn't actually funded by the private sector, right? And yes, Brightline is mostly not funded by the private sector. But as Brightline brings high-speed rail to more corners of the country, ordinary people will realize that these trains are great. High-speed rail will go mainstream like electric cars have gone mainstream, and the right will forget all the federal funding Brightline got, and the narrative will become that America built a world-class transit system with rugged capitalism. Wes Edens very well may become the next evil billionaire poster child, and by the 2040s, leftists will be cursing Brightline's name in the same breath as Tesla and Amazon. And then it'll really be the new Gilded Age. A century ago, the last time there was a major national outcry about the gap between the rich and the poor, the richest people in the world were railroad tycoons. There is nothing new under the sun. I think this is an especially likely future because the first people to ride Brightline's trains and realize how great high-speed rail is will mostly be Republicans, because I expect that after Brightline West is completed and Brightline moves on to other projects, the vast majority of those projects will be in red states, since it's so much easier to build things where there's less regulation. I think it's very easy to imagine that being a supporter of high-speed rail in America in 2050 will have the same political and cultural valence that driving a Ford F-150 does today. And just like all the people today who try to vigorously deny that they ever had an Elon Musk phase, you'll be claiming that you were ahead of the curve. You hated high-speed rail as early as 2025. No, you didn't. And this should make blue state governors and anyone else who pines and sighs looking at what other countries' governments have built really fucking sad. Blue states are too overregulated to build the things that they want. When people complain about overregulation, that gets coded as like a right-wing business conservative kind of take. It's implied that what you mean is you want the government to stop constraining the private sector, but the private sector isn't nearly as regulated as the government itself. Large-scale public sector projects are damn near impossible in the United States because the government has bound itself up with its own red tape. That's why Brightline can build high-speed trains, especially in red states, and the state of California can't. The American state has accidentally killed itself by autoerotic asphyxiation. Private companies don't have to hire Americans. If Brightline wanted to put someone from Spain in charge to determine how to build high-speed rail that seems to be cheap, fast, and good, they could. Whereas if the California High-Speed Rail tried that, it would be a bureaucratic nightmare. They would have to hire people in the US who know how to build high-speed rail, and that's zero people. But the real boogeyman is the thicket of so-called environmental laws that end up being worse for the environment than doing nothing. In most blue states, anyone can sue to stop anything from being built if they can link it to some kind of environmental impact they think it'll have. And of course, if you can hire a good lawyer, you can twist anything to make it sound environmental. Karens have used environmental regulations to stop homeless shelters from being built in their neighborhoods. Businesses have used environmental regulations to prevent competing businesses from opening up next door. Wealthy beachfront property owners in New Jersey blocked what would have been America's biggest offshore wind farm because they thought it would ruin their views, and established case law considers that an environmental harm. Arguably the worst case I've heard of is of an anti-abortion group that used the California Environmental Quality Act to block construction of a new abortion clinic on the grounds that it would cause noise pollution because of all the protesters. Like them. So, governments in blue states, when they want to build something, are forced to do years-long studies examining all the potential environmental harms a project could cause before they even move a shovelful of dirt so they can deflect all the bad faith lawsuits. Here's an average-sized example. This is the full text of the environmental review for Manhattan's congestion pricing scheme, a toll on cars entering Manhattan meant to mitigate traffic and get people riding transit. That's a meter of binders, longer than War and Peace combined with all the Warrior Cats books. Before New York could change their tolling rules, they had to do this, complete with public comment from the residents of 28 counties and politicians who have no ties to New York and never did, ostensibly to determine if congestion pricing would have a net positive impact on the environment, when it should have been this: will the Manhattan congestion pricing scheme have a positive effect on the environment? And so, barring a few loopholes like building down the median of an existing highway, nothing ever gets built, cheap or fast, in American blue states. My favorite example of this, and maybe favorite isn't the right word because this is actually very sad, is that there's one state that is doing way, way better at installing renewable energy and decarbonizing their power grid than any other state, and it's Texas. And you know, Texas is Texas. Texas has passed laws banning their government from conducting business with firms that boycott fossil fuels, and in the summer of 2023, they added a law subsidizing the construction of new natural gas plants, but definitely not subsidizing renewable energy. Meanwhile, the state government of California, for example, shells out great big rebates and tax incentives for building renewable energy, and yet,
According to CNBC, Texas added almost three times as much renewable power capacity as California in 2021, and similar amounts since then. This isn't a fluke. According to the Solar Energies Industry Association, 7 of the top 10 states for adding new solar capacity in 2023 were red states, even though the blue states are trying hard to decarbonize their power grids, and the red states are trying hard not to. But in Texas, they don't have environmental laws that are explicitly anti-doing things. You can build whatever the ass you want in Texas. In blue states, there are laws like the California Environmental Quality Act, supposedly environmental, but they really allow anyone with enough money to hire a good lawyer to stop whatever change they want, even if it's an environmentally friendly project. States without strong environmental laws, the red states, have pulled ahead in the fight against climate change because renewable energy is great, not just from an environmental standpoint, but from an economic one. Wind and solar energy are the cheapest power sources humanity's ever seen. Even if atmospheric science worked completely differently and climate change just wasn't a thing that could happen, wind and solar would still be replacing fossil fuels because they're just better at producing more energy for less these days. And yet, we have such weak state capacity in America that how environmentally minded a state's government is and how much progress they've made decarbonizing their power grid are almost inversely proportional. All the oil money in the world isn't stopping Texas fossil fuels from being taken over by better technologies, because Texas doesn't have any of those burdensome environmental regulations that in practice just serve to keep the status quo in place. So, let's get ourselves some better targeted environmental laws. Let's move beyond the public comment sessions and lawsuits and all the useless decorative bits we burden our infrastructure projects with as a simulacrum of democracy. Because real democracy is when the government can do what the public wants it to do for them. We can't let Wes Edens become the next Elon Musk. We can't let the American right claim high-speed trains, the coolest things in the world, for themselves. And we can't let China sell its Fuxing trains to developing countries saying, look what having a police state can get you. Authoritarianism makes the trains run on time. America doesn't have a good response to that, because our trains sure don't run on time. Democracy is still worth fighting for. When I say I love China, I mean I love the people, the language, the history, the cityscapes, the food, the trains, but not the government. The CCP can suck my all-American elbows. The West is still far more free, and America ought to peacefully win the second Cold War just like we peacefully won the first one. But if our government can't do a goddamn thing, maybe we don't deserve to win. It's time to bring back the home front state capacity that brought us the Tennessee Valley Authority and the Interstate Highway System and put a man on the moon. Are you going to fight or are you going to perish like a dog? Let's get ourselves a motherfucking high-speed train in the US&A and let's call it the Grass Mud Horse.
Minutes early.